This is Bill Tiller of Tiller.org. You're listening to BBSRadio.com. Don't forget to tune in to The Infinite Consciousness with Eva Herr every Sunday at 7 p.m. Pacific Time. Enjoy.
Welcome to Infinite Consciousness tonight, and thanks for listening. This is Eva Herr. And tonight we have with us Dr. Kevin Favreau, and we're going to talk about his book, Science of the Soul. How are you, Kevin?
Good evening. I'm doing well. Thanks, Eva.
You're welcome. Thanks for coming on.
Well, thank you for having me on, and I will appreciate talking with you about this book.
So, tell everybody a little bit about you, your background, how you came to do what you do, and where to find you.
Okay. My background is I have a science degree, Bachelor of Science in Electrical Engineering, and in high school I attended a seminary in anticipation of becoming a priest, and then the merger of those two disciplines led me to wonder about the soul and whether there might be any scientific basis for the soul, because when I got to college, there were times when people would say, well, you know, there's really no basis for believing in a soul. There's no scientific basis for that, so why do you believe in those fairy tales? And so that got me thinking, and I spent quite a bit of time thinking about it and looking for evidence of something that could stand up under a scientific scrutiny, and that's what led me to write this book.
I can understand that inner drive to find out what it is that makes us tick.
Yes.
So where, you have a website?
Yes, website is scienceofsouls.com. I think you have it linked on your website as well.
I do.
And the book is The Science of the Soul, Scientific Evidence of Human Souls.
Okay. So why don't you just start out and tell us about your book?
Okay.
And then I'll ask you some questions.
Sure. I think the first thing to realize from a scientific perspective, there is nothing that science proves. What science does is provides evidence, and then scientists will draw logical conclusions from that evidence. But from a scientific perspective, the evidence is not a proof, but it is just a basis for a belief. Now, as humans, we do believe things, and even scientists believe things, but there are really two main pillars, I think, in most people's belief systems. One would be evidence, and that would fit in with the scientific perspective, and the other is what we would call faith, which is based on what we would call revelation or revealed truths. And so many scientists and many people would say, well, I'll believe based on evidence, but I won't necessarily believe based on faith. So, you know, a lot of people's faith background includes the concept of a soul, and so then I thought, well, let's see if we can support that with evidence basis that would be consistent with science, and that's what I did with my book. We need to have another definition here of what does a natural mean and what does supernatural mean? Because otherwise, we need to have those concepts to be able to talk about a soul, because
right.
I consider the soul to be supernatural. What a scientist does is uses causes and correlations to explain how natural phenomena interact, because through countless experiments, it has been found out that all natural phenomena, at least that experimented with to date, interacts based on causes and correlations. And, in fact, that is sort of a definition of natural, because otherwise you don't have the opposite, which is things that do not interact based on causes and correlations, which are those things that are supernatural. So, if you were asking a scientist, well, how would you know if something is supernatural? You know, if you were trying to find something supernatural, how would you know that was supernatural? And I think the answer would be, well, it would be something that you couldn't have a a scientific theory about, because it would not interact based upon causes and correlations. That, in fact, is what we typically define as a miracle. You know, if something that can't be explained based upon scientific principles, that's what's called a miracle, or in other words, something that's supernatural. So as engineers, we use scientific principles to design things, and we are confident that they will interact and act the way we expect them to, because they are natural phenomena, and they are operating according to those scientific principles. For example, you'll dial a phone number and you'll get the same phone every time. You'll build buildings, you'll build bridges, you'll build airplanes, and they act the way you expect them to under conditions that you expect them to be in because of scientific principles.
I have to say one thing here. When you say based on scientific principles, I guess, just for the listeners, you mean based on current conventional science, right?
That's right.
Super science of quantum mechanics.
I guess there's always new discoveries, new evidence in science, but I'm talking about sort of the very basic principles of science, that being causes and correlations. Science, you know, will find new causes and new correlations and possibly new theories, but it's always based upon something that can, when the scientist says they can explain things, it means they can identify certain causes and correlations are associated with those interactions.
So what is your evidence for existence of the soul?
The evidence that I primarily look at is what I call free will, and I think it's the same thing that people normally think about when they think about free will. And I would define free will as that ability of humans to be able to make choices that are not based upon prior causes and correlations. Because if you think about it for a little bit, if every choice that you made was based upon some prior cause and correlation, it really would not be a free choice. You would just be like a biological robot interacting based upon these causes and correlations that are sort of driving your decisions. So for example, a computer can make choices, but those choices are based upon how that computer was programmed. So a similar corollary would be if every choice that a human made is based upon your genetic programming and all your environmental influences, then those choices, in fact, would not really be free. So I identify this concept of free will that is evidence that there's something else out there that's making these choices, not just based on your biology, your genetics.
Okay. I have a couple of questions. First of all, I believe there's something else out there, so don't get me wrong when I start asking these questions. I just got to do it. Okay. Do you believe that we're binary beings?
Well, if by binary you mean we have a natural aspect to us and a supernatural aspect to us, I would agree with that. I think
what I mean by it is, either we're living or we're not, yes or no, or, you know, there's not a maybe.
I think there are certain things that you can say yes, that it's either this way or that way.
Okay. What do you believe to be, let's talk about the aspects of mind here. Do you think that what is mind to you, first of all?
Well, part of mind is this free will aspect I think mind is and a soul are very, you know, very similar to one another. The mind, I think, works through the soul. It's the ability to make free choices, but it's also the ability to have concepts and the ability to think of things in different ways, you know, to have what we might even call intelligent design. And have concepts like numbers and concepts like freedom and you know, even concepts of free will. I think those are all part of what mind is.
Where do you think mind resides?
I would call it the mind resides in the soul.
Okay. So mind is not connected with brain.
Well, I think a human being, the brain and the mind and the soul are very closely connected. I think there's what our souls perceive and what are very closely interrelated. You know, we as human beings interact with this natural world through our bodies, which of course part of our bodies is, our, in fact, our brain.
So and are you saying that brain interprets mind?
I would say brain interacts with the mind.
Okay. And do you differentiate between what a lot of the scientists out there call big mind and little mind?
I'm not real familiar. Well, I think maybe what they're talking about is big mind being like some supreme being out there, and little mind being each human's mind. Is that kind of what you're talking about?
I don't know that we think it's a being, but we think it's a force or a field or something.
Yes. Well, see, my concept of force is something that follows these causes and correlations. From a scientific perspective, mm-hmm. every time science would use the term force, it refers to something that follows some very specific causes and correlations. So to think of mind in terms of just a force, when I say just a force, I mean only something that interacts based on causes and correlations. But if a mind is freer than that and has more freedom to entertain some of these other concepts, then I guess I would go along with that.
Okay. What do you believe to be the source of creativity?
Once again, that's part of the soul. It's part of the mind. It's the ability to have these concepts, which is sort of part of creativity.
Is it individualized, or is it like down on the irreducible unit and connected by quantum entanglement?
Well, in other words, do humans have some ability to interact with each other through sort of the supernatural means, I guess, is that your question, so that our minds interact as opposed to interacting on a purely natural level? That's I guess I haven't really thought about that too much.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of people out there that say there's evidence for these sort of these entangled minds that people get very comfortable with each other and think in the same terms, so to speak. And a lot of times people will have feelings over maybe a distance where it's difficult to explain from a natural perspective.
Mm-hmm.
But I really haven't done any real investigation of that myself. So I guess I don't have any real evidence of it, but I don't discount it.
Okay. What do you believe is at the irreducible unit?
The irreducible unit.
What is that to you?
Well, I think...
I guess what I want to know is, if you went as far down into a particle as you could go till there was nothing left but energy, what is that in relation to whatever your research has been talking about?
Well, I think if you think in terms of... let's talk about the natural world, first of all. Everything is... could be understood in terms of energy. Remember, Albert Einstein said energy and mass are interchangeable. And as you get down to smaller and smaller particles, like electrons and protons and those kinds of things, and even smaller, many scientists will understand those in terms of what you call forces or waves of energy waves.
Mm-hmm.
That there is nothing really hard, so to speak, or what you might consider, how would I say it? When you think of solid, I guess it maybe is a better word. When you think of a table, you say, well, that table is solid, but why is that? Well, if you took your hand and tried to, you could hit the table and your hand would bounce off of it. But, you know, if you got down to the sort of the atomic quantum level, what's happening is really these bundles of energy are interacting such that they are, you know, repelling each other in such a way that your hand doesn't go through it. But if you looked at the amount of space, even in just a single atom, the proton and neutrons, which form the core of the atom, are very, very small. You know, there's mostly just empty space, so to speak,
right.
Even in an atom. But we see it, things as solid just because those are our perceptions, and we react to them in those ways. But really, what the natural world is a bunch of energy in different forms, just interacting with itself.
Right.
And then the question becomes, our souls, how does our soul...
Wait, let's go back. You never answered the question about the irreducible unit.
Is there an irreducible unit, sort of like down to the...
asking you, let's assume that there is an irreducible unit.
Okay, it's sort of like a super string theory where you get down to these real small particles type thing. Or
the particles
forces.
Are sitting on something.
Mm-hmm.
What are they sitting on?
They're just sitting in space, I guess.
They're not sitting on a field or a wave or some kind of force, maybe a force we haven't discovered yet.
I guess it's possible. What is the fabric of the universe?
In a black hole, you know, there's a tremendous amount of energy in a black hole where there's no particles. So what is that in the black hole? That would be an irreducible unit. What is it?
Mm-hmm.
Because it drives something, particles.
Well, I guess I don't know I don't know that science has come up with anything yet. Some people, like I say, have theories of sort of these very small strings, which is known as the superstring theory,
mm-hmm.
and those are very small. I mean, just to give you an idea of the size of them, if you took the size of an atom and compared it to the size of our solar system, and then you took that same ratio from an atom and went down the other direction, that would be the size of those superstrings. But
guess,
whether that's the undividable particle, I don't know.
The reason I ask that is because we're going to be talking about, you know, whether or not you believe we have free will or not in a minute.
Right.
And if there is some force at the irreducible unit, which they have proven exists, then that drives something. And it will also have something to do with choice randomness.
Well, maybe what you're talking about is there's a possibility of a force at that level that could be the mechanism by which free will interacts with the natural world.
But then it wouldn't be free will for the individual.
Well, I guess it depends on whether this, whatever this underlying thing is, whether it is.
It's what I call the God force. I don't
really
have a word for it, but that's
sure.
What I call the God force.
It's a question whether this God force is the only thing that's interacting with the, you know, sort of the underlying, natural phenomenon that makes up our bodies, or whether as individuals we have an ability to have a sort of our own energy, our own force that can interact sort of separately from this God force, or whether we're somehow tied in with it.
Do you have any opinion on magnetic monopoles and any role that they may play in free will?
I don't. I haven't. I guess that's a possibility of how the soul might interact with it, but I guess I haven't really thought of that.
Okay. So now go ahead into your research, and then we'll talk. I'll ask questions about that too.
Sure.
When we get into that.
Well, you know, the first question is then, do we have free will, and is there any evidence for it? And in fact, you know, a number of scientists have said to me, well, you know, they categorically deny that we have free will because they, first of all, believe we're only made out of out of natural phenomena.
Mm-hmm.
And so they don't want to, they think that by believing in something supernatural, that would make them bad scientists. But I don't agree that that's a correct understanding. Just because science can't explain something doesn't mean it doesn't exist. And scientists should be open to those kinds of understandings. Science itself is only directed at the natural world. And so you can still be a good scientist and find out what science says about the natural world without having to discount that there is a supernatural world.
So let's define. I'd like to hear your definition of what free will is.
Free will is the ability of a human to make a choice that is not due to causes and correlations. Sort of the choice itself is what might be called the first cause. So it's not dependent on some prior cause or some prior force, something that's pushing on it or making it happen.
Mm-hmm. Do you, when you say that we have free will, do you mean that we have complete free will?
Well, I think there's certainly a lot of influences on us. Any choice we make, there's certainly influences. Let's take the example of a person that might be genetically disposed to alcoholism and who grows up in an alcoholic family.
Mm-hmm.
They will have tremendous feelings, probably physical feelings and emotional feelings, that might lead them to want to take a drink of alcohol. But ultimately, I think they have to make the decision to either take that drink of alcohol or not take the drink of alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
There may be other times when these feelings are so overwhelming that for all practical purposes, they go ahead and do drink the alcohol, for example. I mean, you can imagine yourself being in such pain that, you might have a choice whether to take a painkiller or not, but the pain might be so overwhelming that you just do it. So whether you say we have ultimate free will, I think we do, but sometimes it just might be so overwhelming that it's hard to ignore our physical feelings.
Okay, let me ask you this then. So this is a topic most of my friends are scientists, and we have had so many conversations on it, I just can't tell you. Every interview, that's one of the topics that I ask about. Do you think we have complete free will? So I have two things one thing I want to say, and a question, and another thing I want to say. The thing I want to say is, I have a friend who is a guru, for lack of a better word. And one day we were riding down the road, and we were talking about free will, and he said, "Eva, you are not driving that car known as a human body." And I went, yes, I am. You know, I can make whatever choice I want to choose. I can manifest whatever it is I want to manifest. And this was shortly after I had this kind of awakening thing. And he went, "Eva, it's like you're strapped in a car seat with a little yellow steering wheel, and you're 3 years old, and you're sitting in the back seat, and God's driving the car. And you come down, and you think you're driving that car because you've got a steering wheel. You don't know any better. So you come down to the four-way stop, and the playground's on the right, and the grocery store's on the left, and God says, 'I need to go to the grocery store.' And you turn your steering wheel as hard as you can to go right into the playground. And at that moment, you find out you're really not driving your car. Your steering wheel really doesn't work because God's going to the grocery store." So I believe that there is something more, fundamental deep within us, whatever it is, and, you know, who knows what word to attach to that, but that we may not be making all these choices ourselves. Maybe this is the way God experiences by coming into a physical body, because we know emotions is what dopamine and serotonin and norepinephrine, that's not floating around in empty space. So how else would God know how it was to experience anything in physical reality? Now, the second thing that I want to ask you is, if I said, "Kevin, meet me at Starbucks at 3 o'clock, and we have complete free will," if that's what you're saying, If we have complete free will, you will be there at 3 o'clock, and so will I. We won't get there 5 minutes before, and we won't get there 5 minutes after. We won't be late, we won't get a flat tire, we won't get in a wreck, we won't get broken down, or we won't forget. So
when I say we make a choice, it doesn't necessarily mean that we can implement that choice. I might say I choose to fly to the moon, but if I physically can't fly to the moon, I'm not going to do that. So I think we are limited to, you know, physical constraints as to what we can actually do, in spite of how, you know, what kind of choices we make. But as far as whether God controls some of our choices, I guess I don't necessarily discount that. Of course, you know, that's difficult to provide any really good evidence from a scientific perspective as to whether, you know, God is doing that or not. So I wouldn't say that I have any evidence to support it one way or the other than my own feelings that I think God probably, when he wants something done, he probably can influence the way you think fairly strongly so that you will in fact do what he wants you to do. But let me ask you a question. Do you think there's there's times when God says, well, I don't really care what choice Eva makes. I'll just let her make this choice on her own. Don't you think there's times like that?
Well, personally, if you want to talk about my personal opinion, I don't think God gets involved. I think that that there has to be, I think that we live in like a holographic environment and that we signed up, I don't have the vocabulary that I wish I had, but I think that we, so to speak, signed up for a physics class based on how evolved we are, for example. We wouldn't, if we'd been around for a while, our soul, we wouldn't sign up for a third grade reading class. So we signed up for, you know, a college level physics class to learn what it is that we're lacking to learn. And I think that, I think we have the ability to place an intention, but I don't think that we're guaranteed that that intention will occur.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I think we're all subject to physical limitations. We can have intentions and choices, but whether they actually occur or not, you're right. They're subject to what other people do. They're subject to
chemical reactions. For example, depression.
Right.
If we had complete free will, how many people would walk around with depression or poverty? You know, I'd say, oops, I don't think I want that depression anymore, and I'd flip it off. You know, quite frankly, we can do that if we live in the moment. But, you know, you have to be able to get to an evolved state or in an evolved state of mind to be able to be strong enough to do that. So I guess the more evolved a human being is, the more enlightened, I think the more free will someone does have in physical reality.
Right. But I think there's still limitations on what we can, control physically if we're in a car accident, for example, and our body is really smashed up and broken. There's limitations to what we can do to correct that. But by the same token, I don't discount that probably a person's intentions can affect their well-being on a general basis. How you think about things certainly can affect your health and your feelings, but it's very complex, and whether the physical feelings are there first or whether your intentions are there first is probably very difficult to say at times. But
yeah, it is.
It's a very complex and very interesting.
Why don't you talk about your research and tell us what you did?
Well, to come up with evidence for free will, since another thing I think I brought to the table in this book is to document the statements of a number of prominent scientists who agree with me that free will cannot be explained as a natural phenomena. And so then the only thing left at that point is this, if we can show that there is free will, then there is evidence then for something that's not natural or what we call supernatural. One thing I did is developed what I call a free will test, in which I asked certain people to make choices, very simple and yet complex choices, And here I think one thing I did is to make the choices somewhat frivolous. In other words, if a choice has a certain purpose, say like you're choosing what to eat or something, people can say, well, there's a biological reason why they did that, or, you know, there's a emotional reason why they did that. So I tried to come up with something that was totally frivolous, which would then be something you could choose one direction or another direction, and yet show that by being able to make those choices, you could show that you had had free will. And so the choices would be things that would not be have genetic or evolutionary forces behind them and would not have any environmental forces behind them. And so these are simple choices. For example, being able to choose something a certain number of times in a row, or deciding what you were going to choose and then doing it, those kinds of things, which I think are evidence that people, in fact, do have free will. In other words, if you look at trying to describe why did the people made those choices, and you try to list all the reasons from a scientific perspective, you might say, well, were there any genetic reason for those people doing that? No, they didn't, because there's no evolutionary forces behind it. There's no advantage that they get by doing those kinds of choices. There's no environmental factors because no one's forcing them to do it. There's no monetary gain. So you rule out all the other explanatory variables, and you're left with the conclusion that, well, that person did it because they freely chose to do it. And that's the evidence that I proposed in my book.
And how did you conduct that?
I conducted it with a number of individuals where I had them make these choices and documented the choices, and then wrote those up in the book. As I don't know, there was probably 10 or 15 people, or maybe not that many that I did that with, but I think you'll see in looking at it that it's something that anyone can do, and yet it's something that's very clearly choices that are being made totally freely without any implications, for anything else.
Since the readers have not all read your book, tell us specifically what you did.
Looking at, for example, picking up like the an X or an O, and trying to decide whether you're going to do it in a certain pattern or not.
Okay, now was it face down or face up?
I think it was face up.
Well, then they would know what they were picking.
No, I mean, their choices were there. Both were there. The X and the O were both there face up, and they could pick which one they wanted.
Well, then they could decide beforehand, I'm going to pick every other one, so if they could see what it was, that they would pick up every other one, because that's what they wanted to do.
That's right, yes. And so that was evidence that they were doing it freely, because they were the ones that chose what they were going to do. And there's, if you think about it, if there was some sort of evolutionary force going on here, this is something people would have done over time, or maybe they would have picked, there would be some advantage, some evolutionary advantage to doing this.
Oh, I see what you're saying. What you're saying, I was having a hard time seeing how that would mean anything, but
mm-hmm.
You're saying if somebody says, I'm going to pick up XOXOXO, and the numbers are XO or face up so they can see, and then they pick XOXOXO.
Right. Or they can pick 10 X's and 10 O's.
Right, I get you.
And there's really no evolutionary advantage to doing one or the other, and yet you can freely choose to do it.
Uh-huh. Okay. Do you agree that consciousness is in gradients?
Is in what?
Gradients.
Gradients?
Mm-hmm. Have you read David Hawkins' work?
No, I haven't.
Okay. Would you think, what I mean by gradients is, if you were to read Hawkins' work, you would see where through tens of thousands of experiments, He's identified 11 levels of conscious awareness in a human being. So the lower levels are more concerned with materialism like that. So they would probably choose that XOXO. If you get on up high where you speak to an enlightened person, they probably won't choose because they'll say, I don't care.
It could be. That in itself is a choice, of course.
Yes and no. It's something from within where you don't have any desire to do anything anymore. It just, there's nothing to fix.
Right.
And it's not something you can bring on. It's not making a conscious choice not to do it. It's something from within where you have no desire to fix anything. You know, fix a test or run a test even.
Right.
I don't know if that makes any sense.
No, I you know, without having read his work, I think I would tend to agree that there's various levels of, you know, and maybe some of it has to do with how much physical wealth there is that people have the ability to, you know, if you're working most of your waking hours just trying to put food on the table, maybe you're mainly concerned about that, as opposed to if you have satisfied that, you have time maybe to think about other things.
Yeah, that's interesting that's your test, whether you can or cannot pick up X's that you want to pick up. Mm-hmm. I don't know why, but I just didn't get that for some reason. But what else do you have to say about that?
Well, you know,
how does that mean? What does that mean to our lives across the board?
Well, once we have decided or once we believe that we have a spiritual aspect to us, and once we understand that we can make choices, then we have to, you know, part of morality, part of spirituality, I guess maybe spirituality is a better word, is to then decide what are the choices I am going to make in my life, and are they going to be choices for, you know, first of all, just because of the fact we can make choices, that is indication that there is a moral basis for our lives. In other words, if everything we did was because we were robots, I think it would be hard to say that there's really a moral, personal moral responsibility, because, you know, we would just be robots.
Mm-hmm.
And Viktor Frankl, I don't know if you're familiar with him. He's a psychiatrist who was in the concentration camps during World War II. And he has said in Man's Search for Meaning that just the fact that man can make free choices brings meaning to life, because your choices then become real choices that do have meaning. And so you can choose good over evil. You can choose to help people, or you can choose to have a life that has purpose and meaning, is more than just choosing things for yourself. So I think from a spiritual basis, your choices become very important as to how you live your life and how you, in fact, implement your spirituality in the world.
How would you identify those choices that were the right choices before you made them?
Well, being a Christian, I would say the basic premise is that you love God and you love your neighbor, and you do things that would help your neighbor and help yourself. And so you respect the godness in each other. The Bible says that we're created in the image of God, and I believe that is part of that is the soul in us, that God created us to help one another. He created us as beings that are in a community, and we have very social aspects to us, and we're here to help each other. And so that, by doing that, by doing things that do in fact help each other, that's how I identify what is moral. Obviously, if you put people in a gas chamber, that is not helping them, and that would very clearly be something immoral.
Yeah.
Or if you steal from someone, you know, those types of things, or if you, cause injury to them.
Well, now that you've brought up that you're a Christian, can we talk about that?
Sure.
Okay. So I grew up a Baptist, okay?
Right.
Then I converted to a conservative Jew. Now I'm nothing. I'm just spiritual, that's all.
Mm-hmm.
Because I found where religion got, the dogma got into my way of understanding the big picture. So I don't normally hear Christians talk about just God. They always talk about Jesus. Where does that fit in with your work, your evidence?
Well, you know, as far as those kinds of things, of course, they're not. I stayed away from those in the book because those are not. Those get into that. You know, remember I said there were two pillars,
yeah.
One being evidence and one being faith, and those, of course, would be on the faith side of things. But since you ask, I can talk about those in the sense that
you can talk about anything you want to on my show.
Okay.
I might tell you, but you can talk about it.
Right. Since we do have free will, I think that leads to us at times not choosing to do what's right and not choosing to do what's good. And so we then are guilty, you know, of what traditionally has been called sin. And we have fallen short of what God wants us to do and the purpose that he put us on earth. And to make, once man has sinned and fallen away from God, he needed to have, and this, of course, once again, is a theological or a spiritual understanding, but he needed to have a way that this was made right between God and man, and that's where Jesus came in, that he came, took upon himself all of our sins, and by his death, then, he brought salvation because he accepted the punishment for our sins rather than leaving it to us to accept the punishment. So by him dying for us, that brought salvation to mankind and made us right then again with God.
So then why do people have to keep asking forgiveness?
Because that is how we show that we are accepting the salvation from Jesus by recognizing that we have sinned. You know, if we don't recognize our sin, we haven't accepted Jesus, you know, to recognize our sinfulness and be sorry for it. That is part of what we need to do to accept Jesus as the one that is bringing us out of that.
What if it's a Jew? Are you saying that you can't recognize your sin and get forgiveness for it unless you go through Jesus?
Well, I think that's, I guess there may be other ways to receive forgiveness. I just know that is one way I believe is valid.
Well, I like to hear it that way because you're not condemning others that they have to be your way. You know?
Right. I, you know, I'm not God, and so I don't know what all his plans are. I believe in this one plan that I know is valid.
How do you know it's valid?
Well, I believe that it's valid, let's put it that way.
Okay.
It's consistent with what I think sounds, and maybe this is a reasonableness test, but it sounds reasonable to me. It makes sense.
If all I know to say is that I have been a fundamental Baptist in a small town like Mayberry,
mm-hmm.
the way I grew up. And I had a lot of prayers answered. But then I converted to a Jew, and then I still had a lot of prayers answered. And now I don't do either one of them, except I just believe in a higher power and that energy doesn't stop, it just changes form. So in other words, what goes around comes around. So the way I treat other people matters. You know, we've already decided that in science that intention causes some subtle event to go on and change. You know, Bill Pillar's work's already proven that. Emoto's work's proven that. So I just didn't understand why that had to be the only way to go if I had prayers answered all of the different religions that I was.
Yeah, I guess I don't know. You know, there's no way of obviously no proof, no way to prove, so to speak, that one way of belief is one way of faith is the quote right way or not. I guess I would encourage you to read the Gospels and read about the life of Jesus.
Now, how do you think the Gospels got here?
Well, I think there were some people around at the time of Jesus. I guess I haven't looked into a lot of detail, but the common understanding is that they were people that were inspired by God to write these things down.
Right. And so they basically were pieces of channeled information, right? How else would they get it?
There were some eyewitnesses that wrote about this, and some that, you know, probably listened to eyewitnesses.
Mm-hmm. And when Jesus wasn't around, I mean, they had to get it some way, so how'd they get it? So they channeled it.
There were some apostles around, too.
The apostles channeled it, right?
Well, some of them might have still been alive when these were written. I don't know the details of that. But when you say channel it...
do you know what I mean by that word?
That you rely on someone that lived before you to...
No, that's not what I mean at all.
No?
What I mean at all... I channeled a book, and I never thought I would do that.
Mm-hmm.
I could hear it was like it was being dictated in my head, and it was information that I hadn't already known before that subsequently turned out to be true.
Okay.
So where did I get that information? It came in like an idea. You know when you get an idea and you hear it in your head?
Right, right.
Where does that come from? It either comes from ego living in material reality or from God, right?
I think that's right.
Okay. So why would their information be any different from any other evolved being that walked around in the world? Why would I need to read someone else's information if all the information... There's only one truth, right?
Well, because they wrote about a certain individual who God sent... the belief... Christian belief is that Jesus is God, and that there's this.
Okay, now I have another question.
Spiritual Trinity, you know, that there's a God the Father, God the Son, mm-hmm. God the Holy Spirit, and they, you know, they've lived from eternity together, and decided that they wanted to share their love between each other and share their love with some new beings that they decided to create, and they call these beings humans, and gave these human beings an image. You know, they were created in the image of God, and so they give humans the ability to return to God. And Jesus was one of the primary persons that was able to rectify this chasm between God and man. And so that's why I think it's important to read those people that wrote about him.
Okay, now I have another question. Do you believe that there's mass on the quantum level?
Well, once again, on the quantum level, I think you're talking about bundles of energy, of wave energy, that we perceive as something. So when you think of particles, you know, the word particle in my mind conjures up something that's kind of hard.
I guess I'm below the particle level.
Yeah. And the quantum level, like I said, I think it's waves of energy.
Okay.
And that's, in fact, if you look at my book, there are some Nobel Prize-winning scientists who have described it that way as well.
So if we agree that there's no mass on the quantum level and that particles make up whatever mass that there is in physical reality, what differentiates you from me, from Jesus, from John the Baptist, from anybody else, except you've got a blob of particles that sit together, and I've got a blob of particles, and John's got a blob of particles. What differentiates the three of us from not being one?
Well, I think it's the soul. I think, obviously, like you say,
we're talking about down on the quantum level now, okay, where there's only one big soul.
Well, I don't necessarily agree with that. I mean, I think...
There's only one energy on the quantum level.
Well,
we've already established that all throughout your interview.
Well, but I think the human being is more than just the quantum level. I think, you know, there's
But we're particles. So what differentiates us? You know, there's not a border around our aura or our field or our body or soul or something. There's just particles, you know, vibrating at a denser rate.
Mm-hmm.
So why are we not all one? In other words, if Jesus was God, we're God because we're the same. We just have a different level of conscious awareness.
Well, I think we have individual souls, I would think. That's the basis of our free will.
Yeah, I think we do have individual souls, but we only recognize that as we get up particles put together. But before the particles put together, we're of one big giant soul or energy, whatever you want to call it.
You're talking about now the physical level now, the natural level.
I don't know those words, but let's say the dividing point between duality, which some people call the zero point field.
Well, I have,
because Jesus said, "All things that I do, you can do greater." So we have the exact same capabilities as Jesus. Just whether we choose them or not, there's our free will.
That's possible, yes. But I think there's maybe the way the soul interacts with the body is different than at this what you're calling the zero point level. There may be ways in the brain that the soul interacts based upon.
Yeah, I think that obviously because there's gradients in conscious awareness.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're down on the Hawkins has this scale that goes 0 to 100, 101 to 200, 201 to 300, all the way to 1,000 being the Christ consciousness. So nothing's different between anybody except their level of understanding.
Well, I think the ultimate difference between us and Christ is that Christ, in being God...
Why was he God?
Pardon me?
I don't mean to be hard on you here. I just find this really interesting. I'm not trying to be hard on you, but
no,
I don't understand why he was God.
Well...
Because he was like us. And I know people through interviewing this show. I know people that can manipulate matter like he did. I know people, you know, and we know that Christ had emotions because he tore up the synagogue one time when all the people were in there selling their stuff, you know.
Right. Oh, he's
anybody else, but he practices agape more than anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
That's a choice.
I think if, you know, from a theological basis, the difference, one of the main differences is that he was perfect. That he did.
Why was it? Wait, hold on. Why was he perfect? If he tore up the synagogue that day, how was that perfect?
He was perfect because he did not sin. He did not do anything.
If we went up and tore up the synagogue, we'd go to jail.
Possibly.
Yeah, well, you know we would.
Well, I could say from a theological basis, the difference between Christ and us is that first he is infinite, and he's also perfectly good.
Well, so are we.
Well, we do things.
Well,
at
so
times.
Did he.
Pardon me?
He did too.
He did not do anything that was sin.
He tore up the synagogue.
Well, that was not sin.
So if I can go tear up the synagogue and it's not sin, it's hurting people.
Well, I think he knocked over a couple tables with.
Well, we weren't there, so we don't know. But we do know that he tore it up and he got angry.
Well, anger is not necessarily a sin.
No, but tearing up the synagogue was breaking the law.
Well, and breaking the law might not necessarily be a sin either. But I would say my belief is that from a theological perspective, he did not sin. He is God. We are God's creatures. You know, I think Jesus said, "I am." In other words, you know, they asked him who he was, and he said, "Before Abraham came to be, I am." Which
I say that too, though, because I am is everything there is, pure consciousness.
Well, I think each of us have our own individual consciousness that came into existence at a point in time, whereas I think Jesus has been in existence for eternity.
You don't think we have either?
No, I don't. I think God created.
You don't think our soul's been around us as long as his has?
No, I think God created us.
God created him, though.
No, he was God.
No, he wasn't.
Well, that's what I believe. Let's put it that way.
I mean, if there's no mass on the quantum level, what distinguishes it? If you can prove that to me, then I'll believe you.
Well, I doubt if I can prove anything to you, but if there's no mass on the quantum level, all right.
There's just a field of potential.
All right. But I don't know what that has to do. You know, that's what I would call the natural world, and I think God has existed outside of that natural world from all eternity. He created the natural world, and you know, my belief is that he created the natural world so that he could create humans. All of these stars and planets and everything are kind of fun to look at, but the real fun is having human beings that have this ability to choose God and, you know, or reject him, and mm-hmm. he gave us the ability to live our lives and you know, follow what he wants us to do or not.
Okay.
And gives us the ability to try and, you know, return to him or not.
Do you think that everything is conscious?
You mean like rocks and things?
Yeah.
No.
Well, what if there's scientific evidence out there that proves that it is?
Well, I would have to take a look at it. I guess.
For example, Cleve Baxter's work with eggs. Do you think an egg's conscious?
That what? I'm sorry, did what?
An egg is conscious?
Well, an egg is starting to form a sentient being. You know, animals are a very interesting phenomena. And, you know, I guess a lot of people can debate as to whether, you know, what level of consciousness animals have compared to what humans have. I think they're sentient beings. I haven't got much further than that in my thought process.
The reason I ask about the egg, and there's much more to this. Water. Do you think water's conscious?
Well, water, you know, H2O, the hydrogen, oxygen,
mm-hmm.
that I would feel, you know, I think they've done experiments on those types of molecules, and they
mm-hmm.
always interact
mm-hmm.
based on very defined principles. To me, that, you know, when things act based on defined principles, that is getting further away from consciousness. I don't think those types of things have consciousness.
Well, then, how, let me see how much time we have. Oh, God, we got to go. We're going to get cut off.
I think we're running down. Well, I appreciate, again, this opportunity. Once again, my website is scienceofsouls.com.
And how can people email you?
KevinFavero@scienceofsouls.com.
And that's F-A-V-E-R-O, Kevin, F-A-V-E-R-O.
K-E-V-I-N-F-A-V-E-R-O.
At scienceofsouls.com.
Scienceofsouls.com.
Great.
Yeah, if you look at the website, it gives the email address. I would appreciate hearing from people. And there's also describes, if you want to order the book, it's there's a description on the website as well.
Great. Really, I'm not trying to give you a hard time this interview. I'm just curious, that's all.
Oh, sure.
Only way to know what other people think is to ask questions. You know?
I enjoy it, and I enjoy these kinds of discussions.
Thank you, Kevin, and come back again.
All right, thank you very much.
Good night.
Bye, Eva.